We all have women in our lives who have mothered us, cared for, sheltered, nurtured, loved us, even if they didn't birth us. Some women are able to mother in small ways and moments, possibly unintentionally. Others step in during a crisis and with the full weight of their lives assume the role of capital M mother. These women are rarely seen for who they are or what they do. They often fill only paragraphs or pages in the chapters and chapters of a life. They have the potential to rewrite and redirect whatever comes after their moment on the page. At times, their influence extends beyond the children they helped raise and into the lives of the family as a whole. And they do this by working in an imperfect, even highly flawed system with little support or stability.
Today, we'd like to introduce you to one of these women who, by her own admission, didn't think too hard when she decided to put her own body, soul, and life in the middle of families experiencing trauma. She did it to absorb some of the impact and provide some protection, stability, and predictability for some of the children with the highest amount of risk and chaos in their lives. This is Cocoon, Stories of Gestation. I'm Lizzie Heiselt.
And I'm Valerie Best. And this is Sarah.
I'm Sarah Avila, and I am 37, single. I grew up in Monroe, Washington, just a little north of Seattle. I am a software designer, I guess, product designer. At the moment, I work at Whole Foods Bakery, looking for a job. And in the past years, I've taken in friends' children when they needed a place to stay, and then also was a licensed foster parent for the state of Idaho. And I took in a few sets of siblings. So growing up, almost my whole life, my parents did foster care. And they just took in little children because they had a lot of children at home. And so I watched them, even when I went to college, I watched them continue to take in kids that weren't so little anymore. And they changed their lives and they showed them that they mattered and they loved them. And it makes me want to cry just thinking about it, just to see how so many children never have been the most important piece in the adult that cares for them in their life, and what that can do to children can be really difficult. I just really admired that, and I loved it.
Sarah started the process of getting licensed as a foster parent when she was living in what she called punk house in LA with a bunch of other roommates. The licensing was pretty intense, with a lot of classes and tests and background checks and home inspections. She went through it, knowing she wouldn't be able to take any kids at the time, not when she was living with a bunch of roommates in a rundown house in LA. But she did it anyway, thinking that it would make it easier when her situation changed and she did have a house of her own, with extra rooms, to have already been through the process before.
I did that. And then I moved to Idaho, got a job that paid me maybe double what my job in LA paid me. And then bought a house. And I bought a house because I knew that I could, then I would have rooms to. It had to be in Idaho, though, right? Because I couldn't afford something like that in LA. Then I got relicensed in Idaho. Mm-hmm. When you first get licensed and you tell them what you cannot do. And my one and only thing truly was, I cannot have a violent child. I can't have a child with a history of violence. And that was like, I'm sticking to that. I know I won't be able to handle that. I will be afraid. I'm a small woman. I don't have anyone else to help me. I cannot take in a violent child. I have a lot of trauma when people kind of act violently. I just shut down and I'm like, nope. And so I knew that I wouldn't be able to handle that well.
That was her one qualification. And then bam, she was quote unquote ready, more or less, to take in children who needed a home. But even with the licensing and the training and the formal stamp of approval, it still felt kind of sudden when she got her first call.
So they call you and they're like, we've got these kids, can you take them in? And you feel guilty and you're like, I got space, but I'm not ready. And because I'm single, I don't like cooking, I had no food in the house. And so I just like eat out. I also don't have, so they just drop things on you. Like, they're just like, here, this is now your problem. And they drop off two kids, a little girl and a boy, maybe 4 and 10. The boy was 10, maybe. They drop him off. She's peed in the car seat. She's soaking wet. No diapers. They've given me nothing. No extra clothes. The boy has come with an insane amount of medication. An insane amount. I have no idea what to give him, when, how much. It's just like tons of pills in a pill bottle, like in a multi pill bottle. So like, it doesn't say what the medications are. It's chaos. And so I'm all excited. So I've like got a pizza from Little Caesars, and I'm like, oh, they'll love pizza. I want them to feel like they've just been taken from their home. Like, they're just taken straight from their family and put into my house, right? For a reason, or not a good reason. So I'm just trying to do everything I can to make them feel happy, right? Some kind of sugary drink, pizza, I don't know, something to make them feel like, this is gonna be fun. But also, I don't have diapers for her or pull-ups or whatever. And generally, because of the trauma of switching to a random home for a child, it doesn't matter if they were potty trained or not, they're just gonna pee their pants. This is so traumatizing. So I've noticed that that's a big thing that happens. So they give me this soiled, they didn't even give me the car seat. I just didn't have any way to get food, because it was at the very last second. They're like, we're gonna bring them by right now, right? It's like, ah. So I had the pizza delivered, but I didn't have any way to take them to go get food, like, for the next day. And I don't have anywhere to put them the next day. I have to work or something. And so it was very overwhelming for me.
Sarah's open heart and high hopes for these traumatized children were first going to have to deal with the actual physical realities of bringing new people into her home. Clothes, food, sleep. She wanted to follow the foster care rules. She wanted to do her best by the kids. She wanted them to know they are loved. But before they could even be open to that, she needed to take care of those basic needs, none of which were easily met.
So they came and I gave them a bath, which is also a very strange thing, because there's a lot of trauma that happens with children in foster care with baths before they're in foster care, or even maybe when they're in foster care. I don't know. And so it was really overwhelming. And they don't want to sleep because they're not familiar with this bed that they're being put in. They don't know where they're at, or why, or what's going on. These particular children were tested maybe the next day for some type of heavy drugs. I had to take them to go get tested. Anyways, I didn't have a car seat. I didn't know how to take her around. She needed a car seat. Maybe she was younger than 4. Maybe she was like 3 or something. But I didn't have anything. So I had to figure out a way to have someone go pick up groceries for me and bring them to the house, because I didn't know how to feed them because I didn't have any food at the house. It was wild. And it never, it really didn't get, any time that I first get a foster child, it's kind of crazy like that. It's just like, here you go. And there's like, they say you can contact these people, but no one picks up and no one helps you and no one gives you information. I would call my mom crying like every single night after I put him to bed, because I was like, they don't eat healthy food and I need to give them healthy food. And like, I did, that was a real struggle for me. She's like, just make a hamburger helper, it's fine. And I'm like, she's like, a hot dog, no big deal. But like, for me, that was just like, I can't feed them that. And I ended up learning to feed them that, because they don't want to eat, they're not used to eating how I am, salmon and a salad. And like,
it wasn't too long before Sarah found out that because she was working with imperfect people in an imperfect system, she would have to negotiate with the rules and make compromises to do what was in the child's best interest.
Yeah. At first, because there's so much training and there's so many rules with foster care, right? For good reason. But the rules, I realized much later, aren't really there for me. I mean, they are for me. I don't mean to say that like I shouldn't follow the rules, but I slowly realized that me trying to like be super rule follower of the foster care rules was like, it was kind of traumatizing the children even more. Sometimes it's like, they have to sleep in their bed. They can't sleep in your room with you. And like, it was more trauma. Anyways, so I learned I learned more about the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law with the foster care. So at first it was really hard. And then when I learned that no one's going to help you and that these are children that just need you, I think I started to just be like, okay, you know what? It's not about the rules anymore. It's not about anything. It's just about, what do I got to do to like take care of these kids?
The sleeping rules were a big struggle for both Sarah and the children. With those first brother and sister, she learned a lot about how negotiation and compromise can be so much healthier and more healing than rule following.
So, okay. So then let me just be as real as possible. You know how sometimes maybe you have in your life have thoughts of like, what is the worst thing that I've ever done? And I think I've thought about that because I think the worst thing I ever did was I have these two foster children I'm telling you about come to my home. It's my first time. I don't know anything about what's going on. They have some serious trauma. And I'm supposed to not let this little girl sleep anywhere but in her room, in her bed. Like, that's one of the rules. And she would not sleep in her bed. And I feel so bad about being like pushing for the rule rather than pushing for love for this little girl. And so she would like turn into this kind of like aggressive child after I was trying to get her to sleep. She would go to sleep and I would go to leave the room, but then she would wake up because she would realize this person's leaving me. And so she would like latch on really intensely like a wildcat. And I would just like pry her off and like push her like onto the bed. I'm like, no, because like I couldn't do that for too long. And I just feel like that was the worst thing I've ever done in my whole life. And I feel so bad for her. She was such a little baby. And she couldn't sleep in there alone. And I forced her to, kind of. And in the middle of the night, after hours, eventually I could go to my room and cry. And then I would fall asleep. And then she would eventually come into that room and sleep on a couch that I had in my room. And I felt really guilty, but I was like, whatever, I'm not going to keep fighting this. But this happened a lot of times, and I feel so bad for, like, pushing her off of me and, like, putting her on her bed so many times. Really, like, it was traumatic for me, so I can't imagine how it would have been for her.
Sarah framing this incident as the worst thing she'd ever done took me off guard and got me really thinking about what it was she had done and why she felt it was so harmful. Obviously, there was the yelling and screaming and fighting and probably physical restraint. But there is also the next level, the putting rules in front of people, of not being there for a child who had in many ways already felt abandoned. It had me thinking about how aloneness and how not being seen or heard or understood, about feeling powerless in your own life, can be the worst feeling for anyone to experience, especially a child.
And after that set, I never did that stuff again. I was like, whatever, then we're all sleeping in the same room. The sleeping thing is really traumatic. Another time, there was a set of three that I had, and the 2-year-old at the time, she'd just maybe turned 3 or she was still 2, and she would just cry at my door and say, I want my mom, I want my mom, and just be there crying all night. And there was nothing I could do, and eventually I just made her a bed, a mini bed. I built it. And I built it so it would slide underneath my bed frame, and I could pull it out in the middle of the night, and she would sleep in her bed, and then she would come to my door, and then I would let her in and pull out the bed that was her bed, and she would sleep next to me. but I always would first try to put them to sleep in their bed.
There ended up being a lot of opportunities for Sarah to practice putting people ahead of policies and to be willing to absorb hardship herself to protect the already hurting children from experiencing any more trauma.
One sibling said, the last sibling said I had three children. So she was two, then she turned three, and the other one was four, turned five in my care, and then the oldest one was seven, turned eight in my care. And I had them for 7 months, and I was their fourth home in 6 months. So nobody wanted them. They were too bad and too traumatized, honestly. And so I took them in, and at the time I had three children living with me and my friend. It was really crazy, but I was like, these kids need a home. We have four rooms or something in this house. We can make it work. And so it's also like against the rules. You can't just be having foster children living with you when there's other people who aren't licensed there. But no one would take them. There's like, it's so hard to get people to take three traumatized children. And so they were just like, well, we'll make an exception, whatever. They were like, well, just for 2 weeks. And they never found anyone. And I was just like, they're not moving homes again. It had been, it just traumatizes children beyond belief to have to move into a new home. They have no control. They have no control of their life. They don't know what's going to happen next.
As Sarah opened up and rearranged her life to be able to be there physically and emotionally for these children, she got to witness some pretty amazing things happen in their lives.
One of the children, those three, the middle one, he was four. He was turning five. When he came, they were obsessed with doing art. I don't think they'd ever watched TV. I think they mostly had just all lived in a van for almost their whole lives. So they weren't really familiar with just putting them in front of a TV and that was, you know, or having them watch a movie or play video games. So we were doing a lot of art where I had a whole dining room table. I had two tables. One was for eating on, one was strictly for art. So it was like, you can make a mess on this table and we don't have to clean it up for dinner. We can just leave it and we don't have to stress about cleaning up all your art stuff all the time. And so they did art on that table and everything that he did was symmetrical. It was like, I thought, maybe this child is a genius. Maybe he is like a mathematician, like math, brain, science. He was like every card, if it was a flower on one side, there was another flower on the other side. And everything was just like, it was all symmetrical and really so intriguing and interesting. And then after four months, they continued to do lots of art in my home and nothing was symmetrical anymore. It was so interesting, but also he had gained a lot of control of his environment. He had a bedtime, I had a laundry chute. Oh, I love the laundry chute in my house. So every time we would get home from anything at night, they knew, okay, we got to go to the laundry chute, put our dirty clothes in there, take a bath, or if it wasn't a bath day, then they would just go downstairs, put on their pajamas and get in bed. And they all had so much time before bed to read stories, play with each other, whatever it is. They just had to be in their pajamas in their room while I put their little sister to sleep, really, is what was going on. And so I just thought that was really interesting. I think for me, I think it was the control. So like his art was so symmetrical because he's like, I need some control in my life. There's none. And it was expressed in this way later on down the road when everything was, I mean, their behaviors switched so dramatically. I won't even say it's because, oh, I'm just so great. I think it was just because I implemented structure and they knew, right? They knew where their bed was. They knew where they were sleeping. They knew when dinner was. They knew they were eating. They knew that they were, all these things, this intense structure helped them to feel like they had control in their life. And then he could be free to do whatever art he wanted. And it didn't feel like that's where he needed to like implement his own control. It was really, really interesting to me. I made that up. Might be true, might not be, but those are two different things I saw.
That kind of experience, being able to see the effects of structure and stability and predictability on a child's life, is powerful and heartening. But of course, not all experiences are like that. Sarah is haunted by some of the choices she made and the situations she had to deal with. But no experience is wasted, and through them she was able to develop a greater sense of her boundaries and her strengths. It was actually that first sibling set, the 4-year-old girl and 10-year-old boy, that really haunts her.
The first set that I had was a few weeks. Actually, this was probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. So I tell them, like, no violent children. They tell me when they're asking me to take this sibling set, they're asking, you know, my one thing is there a history of violence? No, not that we know of. No. And so I'm like, okay. So I take them. Well, the boy was very violent, and I found myself in situations that were too much for me. Particularly one situation, he would change his demeanor to be really different. And there was nothing I could do about it. It was obviously some type of health issue that I had no idea about, nor could I help it. And he would just get upset and angry, and then he like threw one of the kitchen chairs at my computer, my desktop computer, and was just getting too much. And I'm trying to call these resources and no one's answering, and I don't know what else to do. So I called the cops, which was so traumatic because these big giant men in these blue uniforms come to the door and come in, and they don't have any training to help with the kids. And so they're making it worse, and they're like forcing him to sit down and holding him down. And I'm like, no, like he doesn't need to sit down. Like, he's not being violent, so you don't need to force him to sit, right? I'm not getting involved though, because I need them to help me. And it was awful. This was really hard for me. I had to call, because it was my very first time with foster kids, and I felt like maybe people thought I couldn't do it because they're like, wow, she's really young and she's single and she doesn't know what she's doing and how to parent. And so I just felt this really big sense of failure if I told them that I couldn't do it and couldn't take these kids anymore, right? It's the worst thing. They're like, do not give the kids back, because then they have to go to another home. And that's really traumatizing for the children to move homes. And I knew that I couldn't do it anymore.
Despite the fact that Sarah felt really alone some of these moments, like the foster care system had abandoned her, she also felt that they were just waiting for her to fail. Part of working within a system is that it can be hard to know when you are working for the system and when you are working despite it. Some of the best work she did was in defiance of the rules, and some of the hardest moments were moments when the system wasn't there to support her. The way she got through it was by focusing on the kids and their needs and just loving them as best she could.
I mean, I spent every night singing to these kids in bed for hours. Like, I loved them. I gave them a lot of attention, a lot of my time, but I knew that I couldn't handle these violent situations. And so I called the social worker and I said, I can't, you have to find a different home for this set. My first time. And I was so, I just felt like a total failure. And I felt like maybe, and nobody told me that I couldn't do it, but I just assumed, right? I just felt like people won't think I can do this. In all my classes, I'm the only one that's single. I'm just the youngest person, and I'm a female. Like, I don't know. I just had a feeling that people might be like, who's this young girl in here thinking she can take in some traumatized children? And so I felt like I failed the very first time that I had an opportunity, but I also felt betrayed because I knew I couldn't take a violent child in, and they gave me one anyways, even when I asked. It was a lot of suffering for that. And while the next family was coming to pick them up, this boy and his little sister were sitting on the couch with me, and I'm waiting for this family, and he's just like in love with me. And he's like, no, like, I'm going to miss you so much. I'm going to miss you so much. And he's like, let's sing the song that you sing to me every night. And I said, okay. And so it was Close Your Eyes by James Taylor, because my dad always sang that to me growing up every night. And so I was shocked. I hadn't had them for very long, and he had the whole thing memorized, and he sang the whole thing with me. And it was really tender. And this family came and picked him up, and the family was very annoyed at me, frustrated at me, because I didn't know anything. I didn't know what medications to give, when to give them. They were annoyed at me because I didn't have a car seat for her, or these, like, I may have, but like, I didn't want to give them mine because then I'd have to buy another one. It was a lot of things that they just thought, like, why don't you have this in order, and why are you giving these kids up? And I felt very judged and really embarrassed. And I was extra frustrated because I wasn't given any tools. Like, I don't know. No one told me. I asked about the medication. I asked all these things. And the social worker switched in there while they were in my care too. So they had a new social worker who knew nothing either. So I just, it was like really traumatizing for me to give them to another home. And then the new foster parents were really judgmental of me and talking rude to me. And I really felt that was really hard for me. And then it was a bit redeeming because after that, he wanted to continue calling me almost every day. And eventually the foster mom said, wow, you must have really made a really big difference in his life because he misses you so much, and he turns to you and he wants to call you before school every day to get some type of validation that he can do it. And I felt like, thank you. I felt like really happy that she would, in a way, like, I guess maybe not be so prideful and even tell me that I did a good job. And even though after she was kind of rude and judgmental to me about it all. But anyways, that was my first experience. That was really, really hard.
One of the many hard things about foster care is how temporary it is, or can be. She couldn't know the end of the story, or even the next chapter. So Sarah focused on making her chapter of their story the best she could make it, and then hoped that it might change the course of subsequent chapters, or spark something inside a child that they might be able to nurture on their own, or recognize when they see it again later in life.
The next experience, I had a 16-year-old boy. Nobody wanted him. Because he was in foster care because no adult could take care of him. It wasn't that, like, he was traumatizing the adults who were his caretakers. His parents couldn't take care of him, and he would run away for months. He was involved in drugs and making pornography. They thought that he was going to commit suicide the night that they put him in my home. What are they thinking? How do children not have anywhere to go? Except my house? That's insane. So he comes in, dragging his feet into some random person's home. This is foster care, okay? So this is his first time in foster care. So he thinks this is like the most shame. He's like, I don't want to be in foster care. And he comes in and he's just mad. And he's just silent. And he's just, you know, sitting down and probably shaking his leg really hard. And there's the social worker just in front of him telling me all the bad things about him. Telling me all the things that why he's there and looking at him like, right, right. And he's like not talking. She leaves and I'm like, let me show you your room. There's two rooms. You can choose whichever one you want. And he chose the one downstairs that's like in the basement, and more private and has kind of like this secret like cove space. It's an interesting house. We go down there. I'm like, this is your room. You can put your stuff in here. You can stay in here. And I stopped and I said, I'm not trying to be your mom. I'm not trying to be your new mom. We're literally roommates. And everything that she just told me and everything that anyone's ever said about you, I don't care about, because you've never, ever done anything bad to me. So if this is how you want to start like a new life, whatever you want to do, now's your chance, because you've never disappointed me. You've never broke my trust. And we're just roommates, and I'll take you to go get food. I'm not going to make you home cook meals because I don't cook. So we're just going to go out and eat all the time together. And this is how it's going to be. And he was like, okay, thanks. And I went upstairs and I just let him be. And they said, if he runs away, call the cops. And if anything happens, call the cops. And they were kind of like asking me to be on suicide watch. And I went upstairs and just did my own thing. I was just like, I'm just going to keep doing my own thing. I'm not going to try to get into his space because he's a teenage boy and he just clearly wants some independence. And eventually he came upstairs and just kind of like hung out around me. We didn't really talk. And then, oh, another thing, he wasn't eating and no one could get him to eat. And so eventually I was like, well, I'm going to go get some food at Freddy's. I think they got hamburgers over there. It's just right down there. I have a fancy Audi race car. We can ride in it together if you want. Actually, you don't have a choice. You have to come with me. And so we get in the car and we go to Freddy's and he orders food and we go back and we eat it together. And he opens up to me and it tells me about how he really feels inside. And it's really sad. And the next day, I see this boy go down to the basement window. Some kid is riding his some like little BMX bike or something. I see him from the upstairs down tapping on the basement window. I'm like, oh crap, there's these teenage boys coming over. What's gonna happen? I don't know what to do with teenagers. So I see this kid. I'm thinking he's gonna try to like sneak in the house or something. So I just go outside and I'm like, hey, you know, the front door is just over here if you're coming in. And they're so scared. They're so scared out of their mind. They're like, oh, that I saw them. And he's like, okay. So he comes through the front door and goes and hangs out with his friend downstairs, this foster child. And then they come upstairs and they're like, hey, do you care if we go to some friend's house? I'm like, you're not allowed to leave Rexburg. So if it's in Rexburg, sure. Like I just kept putting everything on to like the state. I'm like, this isn't me. I'd let you go anywhere you want, but I can't. You have to stay in Rexburg. And if, you know, so I tell him, yeah. But in my mind, I'm like, no, you can't let him go. You cannot let this child go. You're going to get in so much trouble. But I had like this internal prayer and I'm like, help me know what to do, because I have no idea what to do. And why did these people entrust me with this craziness? I'm like, I'm a teenager too. What am I gonna do? So they go and they, I said like, okay, just share your location with me on your phone. He's like, okay. So he shares his location with me. They go off to some friend's house, I guess. And then later, oh, this is another, I said, okay, let's make a curfew. let's like come up with a curfew together, maybe, right? I'm like, I don't know what to do here. So I'm like, you can go out and hang out with your friends, no riding in cars with anyone, and let's make up a curfew. So I said, like, what do you think your curfew should be? And he says, 6. I'm like, whoa, 6 p.m.? I'm thinking he's going to say, like, late. I was like, perfect. 6 is great. So they go out, maybe like around 4 or something. He calls me and I'm like, hey, what's up? And he's like, oh, I just want to let you know that, we're just going to go to another friend's house. It's still in Rexburg and I'm still sharing my location. I just want to let you know where I'm at. I'm like, okay, great. I was like, what? This is crazy. I never asked him to do that. And so he goes, and just right before 6, it was like 5:58, they come rolling up on some, like, I don't know, little bikes or something, walking up to the door, and I'm like, okay, it's 6 o'clock, great. It was so cool. It was so cool to see. It was hard, though. That's, maybe not every situation would turn out like that. But that one in particular was really special to me. I felt like if you show love to somebody, if you let them, allow them to prove that they are an intellectual human being that can be trusted, that was really special. Because now that one in particular, a lot of people were like, whoa, what is happening? This, we're not having any problems with this kid in her home. And they thought what was going to happen was the very opposite of what happened.
The teenager was only with her for a couple of weeks before his parents chose to send him to a wilderness or rehabilitation school in another state. Sarah wished she could have held on to him since he seemed to be doing well in her care, but that wasn't her call to make.
I was like, why do that? He's doing great here. But they took him anyways. They took him out of school. He wouldn't go to school. They were surprised I even got him to go to school. And they picked him up from school. It was really hard because I felt kind of like I was betraying him by not telling him that they were going to do that. I just pretended like I didn't know. So that he would know that I really, truly did love him and try not to be like in on this awful trick, I guess. But anyway, that happened. That made me sad. He texted me on the way out. He was telling me some stuff, and he just said, you did a really good job. Thank you.
And often, that kind of a note is the ending of the story for Sarah. She doesn't get to know what happens next. She steps in, takes charge of a chapter of their lives, and tries to make it as full of love and trust, of predictability and control as she can. Her hope, of course, is that the way she loves them, singing with them at night, feeding them the same time every day, making sure they have clean bodies and clean clothes, sticks with them and gives them something to work for in their own lives. She hopes that she can be a person who sees the best in them, who shows them how people can and should treat each other, and accepts them as they are so that they can have a firm foundation on which to build a better life. Of course, Sarah knew that going in. Her experience as a foster sibling growing up prepared her for the heartbreak that can happen when a foster placement ends.
My parents had a child for like, he was 4 when the state gave him back to his dad, but they had him for 3 years. My parents had him for 3 years. They were going to adopt him, and then they just took him away and put him back with the parents on like that. They just, never again can you see this child. And it's just so sad. You're like, oh, but I love that child. And you just hope, really, you just hope that the love that you gave, because you give a real, it's like super concentrated love in a short amount of time. But these kids, you're like, you give so much concentrated love in such a short amount of time that it drains you, and you can't take more kids in for a minute. You're like, okay, halt on the foster care for a minute. I can't do this for a second, because they need so much love and attention. And so, yeah, you do, like, you always think of them, pray about them, love them, hope that they're doing well, and just hope that they saw what things could be, you know? And that makes a huge difference. I know in my own life that makes a big difference. When I was able to live in a home as a missionary.
Sarah served a mission for her church in Dallas, Texas in her early 20s.
Of a wife and a husband that was really emotionally mature. I saw that. And it was just only a couple months I saw it. And I have been able to take away so much from it, knowing like, oh, this exists, right? I'm not perfect with that. I'm not great with that. But I at least know what I could be or become or what I could have, right? And so I think about that kind of thing. They know that someone can love them. They know that someone can be there every single night singing them a song. talking to them, asking them about what they're feeling, just wondering what they're afraid of, and letting them know the things that they should know that they don't know about safety and what people shouldn't do to you, what's not okay. Kids don't know that unless someone tells them. So adults don't know that unless someone tells them. And so I think that it's really interesting, but it can go such a long way through someone's life just in a couple weeks, what you can give to some children.
Which is not to say at all that these kids don't have parents and other people who love and care for them and who try to do their best for them. But of course, these kids are in foster care for a reason. Something has gone terribly wrong. And that in itself is something difficult to face. Sarah and other foster parents sometimes have to tread carefully because, as she says,
generally, a lot of the parents, they don't want to know that there's a better parent than them, right? They don't want someone else to take care of their kids. And in fact, if I can say, I definitely don't love the foster care system. It really hurts people who are less fortunate. Like, they don't have family, so their kids have to get taken away and put into a random home that they don't know where they're at. Generally, it affects mothers because dads just always leave. So it's a lot of poor mothers that can't afford, especially people who are not white, right, who have less opportunity. It's like really affects them. How can they afford to house their children? Oh, it makes me really upset, but it's the only organization, really. So it's like you have to be a part of it or just be mad at it.
It really is an act of faith to step into this system that is flawed, underfunded, short-staffed, maligned, but also extremely important. And to say, I know that it is flawed, underfunded, short-staffed, but I'm still going to do the best I can with it because it is what we have to work with right now.
A huge part that is also frustrating is our government, right, has so much money and they're saying, but not enough for our children or our mothers. Well, only for military. Not enough for our children or mothers, though. That actually, we're going to need the community to help. Who's going to step in here and take in a bunch of traumatized children and then try to love these mothers as well? Who's going to, any volunteers? It's like, what? It's not only underfunded, it's basically not funded. It's like just asking the community to volunteer for the parts of our society that need the most attention.
Yeah, if you're wanting to change this society, you gotta start with the babies.
Why is it volunteers that have, like, I have no training and you just put a teenager in my home that you thought was going to commit suicide that night. You thought that would be a good idea? How do we not have enough money for that?
I asked Sarah how she felt that night with this suicidal teenager in her care. Was she nervous? Afraid?
Oh, interesting. Actually, you know what? I wasn't afraid of that particular thing. I've had thoughts of suicide in my life. So I think for me, I didn't think about that part. That's interesting. I think I just felt only empathy. I didn't think about myself at all or my home. But that would have been really awful.
It is clear to Sarah and to many others that our priorities as a society are upside down. Investing in children and mothers early on would, by many calculations, save our society not only a lot of money, but a lot of grief and pain. If Sarah could have it her own way,
I would say, like, in our society, the things that we need most are care, physical and mental health care, and that's not given, right? These children wouldn't be in these situations if those things probably were accessible to their mothers. We don't need neighbors to volunteer to take in traumatized children. Like, let's just get everybody some help. Mothers can get help with finances. If your husband leaves you with kids, let's not make it difficult to get the help that you need. Sure, we have some help, but that's not even like, I've visited a mother here
in Brooklyn
who has two children, one child with cerebral palsy, and she lives in the projects, and she's awesome. And I showed a picture to my friend of me, like, not, it was just because I was like, look how, you know, look at this sweet picture, right? It was nothing about showing anything off. And they were like, where were you? Like, that looks like a third world country. And I'm like, she doesn't have a choice. This is how she has to live. But why? We have so much money in our country and communities. I'm obviously equality. Equality will just help. I don't have like a, if I had to say one thing, it would be if people could get access to physical and mental health care. I mean, does that even mean abortions, right? It's a huge thing because
that's healthcare.
I am very comfortable acknowledging that it's not necessarily the woman that is initiating all this sex all the time. And here we have these mothers with a bunch of kids. They're actually not allowed to say anyone took advantage of them either, right? What would happen if they said that? What happened if they went to... I have so many thoughts on this. It's like women just don't get the health care they need. They don't get the mental health care they need. They don't get the physical health care they need. Nobody will believe them. Everybody judges any behaviors that they have. As a mother, you're expected to manage a whole entire house, but you've never had anyone help you know how to manage anything before. And it's just like the only things that mothers seem to get is judgments. They don't get promotions. They don't get like title changes. They don't get anything. I mean, they get the love of their children, which is awesome. And the reason why mothers would 100% always be doing this, but like they're just left. They're left with no money. They're left with no care. They're left with no help. They're just left. And these are the mothers whose children go in foster care. They have no other. They don't have a way to take care of their children. They want to. That's why they still have their children. So I guess mental health help, physical like health help, and maybe people would listen to them, believe them, give them care, preventative care, even like just, they're invisible.
Sarah sees the unfairness of the foster care system very clearly. The fact that our society doesn't invest in women and children in meaningful ways. The fact that poverty actually isn't a personal moral failing, but doing so little about it as a society is a moral failing. But she also sees the unfairness of the system that she is a part of.
I'm not one to hold back my honesty, but there were times when I was caring for these three children for 7 months, and I was getting very close with them, and I felt really gross because I just thought, like, I love you guys. Weren't we having a fun time? Isn't this great? Our lives, right? And I'm like, oh, this is a mother's children. The state took them away. She was in foster care. The state took these kids from her, and I'm just having a fun time. We're going to swimming lessons and soccer and rock climbing, and we're reading books at night together. And guess what? I have everything. I own a home. I can feed you guys. I had good parents. So I just get to be your mom. It's awful. I get more opportunity, so I get to be your mom. That's insane.
It is a hard truth to swallow and a hard road to walk on, to show the children what life can be while still acknowledging that their mothers are doing the best they can with too many burdens and too little resources. But just by being there, being willing to step in, Sarah has had the opportunity to be a person that the mothers can learn from as well.
The last three that I had for 7 months, their mom gosh, she's so cool because she's like, she just thanks me. She thanks me for taking care of her kids. I love that. She gave them like phone watches and they called me so many times a day forever for months and months. They don't really do it anymore. It's been over a year now. So they don't call me as much. Once in a while, I'll get a call from them. But for a long time, they were calling me all the time. And I just love that she allowed that open communication and that she thanked me for being there when she couldn't. So I was surprised that she was just really grateful because I was a part of a system that really honestly tears kids away from mothers without just giving mothers help.
Right now, Sarah is not at a place or a point in her life where she can take in foster children. But she has thought about getting there again and what would need to happen for her to possibly adopt from foster care. She's also seen how being a foster mom has been helpful to her in her own mental health struggles, something that weighs on both sides of the equation.
A little bit of me is a little bit, I'm a little bit afraid because sometimes my mental health is fragile. And so it's kind of nice to be like, give, these kids need you. And as you both probably have experienced, and I talk to my therapist a lot about this, the kids sometimes keep you going. Like, oh, they need to be fed. They need to get to school. They need someone to bathe them. They need to put someone to help them put their clothes on. So you have to get up and get out of bed. So it actually helped me a lot with my depression. They needed my care. I felt like I can't lay here. I actually have to get up and do something. Otherwise, they won't survive. So that's helpful, but also, this isn't me, but maybe other mothers, am I actually depressed and wanting to lay here because of the kids? It's a real tricky thing. Someone who gets to think about it a lot, right? A lot of mothers, I feel like maybe they don't even understand it so much and they just go into it and they have kids and then they just have to do it. You don't get a choice. But I keep getting to have choices. And so sometimes for me, it's easier to be like, I don't know if I want to do this full time, all the time. Like, it's kind of nice to be like, okay, I'll take them for 6 months. I'll take them for a year. And then I get to have whatever time off I want. Go on a vacation, move to Brooklyn, hang out with friends, watch movies in the movie theater. When I was a single mom of three, I couldn't think of myself for 1 second. And so I think my takeaway from that is, for me, because I get to think a lot about what I want, and I don't just have kids that need me for 18 years, it's nice for me to just be like, okay, I'll take kids when I can, and then I will hang out and do what I want later.
Sarah has a perspective that I haven't heard very much, which is that anyone in the world could be her child. She's never felt like she needed to carry and birth a child to be connected to it in a parental way. And so maybe that is why she is able to step in for those who weren't ready to do that or who have struggled to do it competently.
I mean, there's this natural... we're born with this idea that like, but I want to grow a baby that's like me. That could it look something like me and someone else that I love? Could it take on my interests? Could it be an artist like me? It's a weirdly selfish thing to think that has nothing to do with this child that's totally separate from you. That's just a human that you get to be in, that gets to be in your care. I notice a lot of times parents have expectations that they put on these children of who they should become. And somehow they align with what the parent is wanting or like. That is something I think that I'm sure is a benefit to like helping us to reproduce and keep the world going with humans. But I do feel really lucky to have grown up in a home where my dad adopted my mom's two children that she had already had and treated them just as his own. There was absolutely no difference. And still to this day, there's not. And we had foster children after foster children. And I watched my parents put everything into these children and try to love them and teach us as children that they're just as important as we are. They just haven't been given the same things as we have. And so growing up with this knowledge of how to view children and babies and humans, I never thought I want to grow my own baby and I want it to be like me. And I never thought that I wanted to have a baby with somebody that I loved, that we could produce something beautiful like that. I just thought of babies and children as human beings that exist on this in this world, and they need some love desperately. And I'm not saying the other way is bad at all. It's wonderful. It's different. But I think that maybe the way that I think about babies and humans, I don't think a lot of people can comprehend it.
To be able to take an interest and give the love wherever it is needed is a gift, as is being able to let go and move on when that chapter ends and to start another one with a different setting, different characters, different priorities. Which is not to say that Sarah moves on entirely, of course. As we were closing up our conversation, she showed us a picture she had tacked to her wall.
This is a drawing from one of the foster children. Okay. This was after he went home to his mom, and I went and visited them. And it's his mom told me that he drew it for me, and she gave it to me. And it says, so the red, in the red side, it says me, and it's a picture of him. And it says, I love Sarah, and Sarah loves me. And then in the green is me, and it says, Sarah, Sarah loves me, and I love Sarah.
So is this the child who was like, everything is symmetrical? Or is
this his older brother who is not symmetrical, who is the greatest artist and wants to make all the big art. And it was so big that I bought him a bunch of little origami pages because I'm like, can keep your art to this size. And I like give him these, right? Because he's just like, just stapling the world together in my house. And then he takes all of those origami papers and tapes them all together. And it's this big, giant, huge, colorful art. And we put it in this big window that we had in the front. And it was so gorgeous. It was like a stained glass thing. But I learned so much from him. He wasn't going to contain his art into a small space.
Clearly, neither is Sarah. Thank you, Sarah, for sharing your story and your insights with us. Thank you for being willing and making yourself able to mother those in crisis and to absorb the trauma, and then send them off with love and hope and peace and even a song in their hearts. You did a really good job.